I'm Andrew Tibb, and welcome to CBS Mornings On The Go. Ahead on this Thursday, July 30th, when it comes to kids and caffeine, can it be harmful and how much is too much? Dr. Celine Gounder stops by with advice every parent needs to hear. Then it feels like there's a new story about AI almost every day. Is it evolving too quickly? We're going to talk with CBS News contributor Matt Schumer about where we are and where we're going. And extreme looks maxing is becoming a dangerous trend that's all over social media. But is the drive to be more attractive actually making men less appealing? Arthur C. Brooks has some thoughts and he'll share them with us. Plus, the inaugural season of the Women's Pro Baseball League is here. Only on CBS Mornings, we'll talk to the league's co-founder and the first overall draft pick. All that and more ahead.
We begin with a new round of attacks by the U.S. and Iran. U.S. forces hit Iran's Revolutionary Guard overnight. Iran fired ballistic missiles, killing one person in Kuwait. And for the first time, Egypt was a target of a suspected Iranian attack. Let's get the latest from Charlie Daggett in Jordan's capital city. Charlie, good morning.
Good morning to you, Nate. Yeah, multiple major developments in the past 24 hours. We'll start with Egypt, saying two cargo ships were struck in a drone strike, including an American flagged vessel. Officials at U.S. Central Command, we just spoke to them, tell us forces launched another round of airstrikes for the first time in days. They were targeting the usual suspects, military command centers, missile and drone facilities, and coastal surveillance sites. That was in retaliation for another attempt Iranian missile strike at U.S. forces here in Jordan. Five missiles aimed at that base. All of them were intercepted, according to Jordanian military authorities that we spoke to. Saudi Arabia now entering the fight, too, in a coordinated joint strike. That was along U.S. fighter jets bombing targets in Iraq, not Iran. Iraq going after Iranian-backed militias that had launched drone strikes on Saudi Arabian oil facilities. So three more countries and counting. Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Egypt, adding to Kuwait, Bahrain, and of course here in Jordan, which has been squarely in the crosshairs of Iranian attacks in the past couple of weeks after really avoiding the worst of it for months since the war began. Natalie?
Charlie Daggett in Jordan, thanks so much. Here at home, the Northeast saw a second day of extreme flooding. It collapsed this 300-year-old mill near Albany, New York, on Wednesday. Some people had to be rescued there after the region got nearly a foot of rain in less than a day. CBS News meteorologist Rob Marciano is tracking a new flood threat moving across the country. Rob, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Natalie. Yeah, Albany set a two-day all-time record for the amount of rain they saw, which was over 6 inches, but some of these areas got nearly a foot in the upper Hudson Valley there. So we're glad to see this rain go away, but some of the rivers are still high, and obviously the ground is saturated. We've got a little bit more rain coming. A little bit today, this will kind of wind itself down, but there'll be some isolated downpours. The next storm you spoke of, that's coming into the upper Midwest today. We'll get into Des Moines, St. Louis tomorrow morning, eventually into Chicago. Some of these will have some heavy downpours, and they'll spread into Cincinnati all the way down through Birmingham, Alabama, maybe 3 to 6 inches of rainfall out of this. So be aware of potentially some flash flooding. We had record-breaking heat yesterday. This was the result as an elderly man and his younger family were hiking a mountain just outside of Phoenix. This is Mummy Mountain, just north of Camelback. This 72-year-old, he's actually an award-winning Disney animator, Vlad, and he got up there. He used to hike this mountain all the time with his kids, but he got up there as a kid. He got up there, he realized he was in trouble, and they had to airlift him out. More dangerous heat coming in the coming days.
But, wow. Yeah. All right. Rob Marciano, thank you very much. The music world is paying tribute this morning to Irish singer-songwriter Glenn Hansard. The Oscar-winning Frames frontman died in a motorcycle accident in Dublin on Wednesday. He also performed in the folk rock duo The Swell Season, who performed a year ago this weekend on Saturday Sessions for CBS Saturday Morning. Musician Billie Eilish posted this image on social media, writing, quote, devastated, wouldn't be who I am today without Glenn. Her brother Phineas said, his songs made me want to write songs. Glenn Hansard was 56 years old, and a lot of musicians and just fans of music and fans of Glenn have been posting on social media how devastating this news was, came out of nowhere.
Truly, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now to today's Health Watch. We have new data on kids and their caffeine consumption. And I know that sentence, it sounds crazy to you. Well, new CDC report, it found that nearly two-thirds of American kids ages 2 to 19 have caffeine in their diet. On average, it found kids had 19.4 milligrams of caffeine on a given day. That's about two-thirds of what's in a can of Coca-Cola. Joining us now, CBS News medical contributor, correspondent Dr. Celine Gounder. She is also editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so what are some of the main sources that kids are getting their caffeine from?
So things like cookies and cake were actually the number one source.
What?
So it's the chocolate that has the caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't even caffeinated beverages like soda. It's the desserts. Oh.
And what is the impact on kids' health? I mean, and how much is too much?
Right. So the main thing we know is about sleep. And the best study we have of this was looking at kids 13 to 15 years old. Were they getting less than 6 hours of sleep or not? And those who were getting at the low end of caffeine, only 3% were having less than 6 hours of sleep. Those who were getting at the high end of caffeine, that shot up to 24% who were not getting enough sleep. And some of this also depends on timing. If they're having the caffeine in the evening. So it's not just you don't want to have coffee in the evening. If you're a kid, you may not want to have that cake and cookies in the evening either.
Dessert. So what should parents be doing? How do they manage this?
Well, the problem is we don't actually know what is a safe level of caffeine in kids. We don't know what is too much. There is you have the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics, that says no caffeine, but that's because we don't know. There's no requirement to label everything with caffeine. Mm-hmm. And labeling would not be a ban, by the way. So one of the things parents can be asking for of the food companies is, hey, label this stuff so I know how much caffeine is in the food. Asking NIH for research on this. And maybe think twice about giving melatonin in the evening to your kid.
Oh.
Right? Like, instead, maybe it's don't give them cookies and, you know, chocolate and so on in the evening.
Yeah, I just learned a lot because we're a sweet tooth family. After dinner, my daughter always says, you want chocolate chip cookies?
Yeah.
And we all raise our hand and we make cookies. And she's up all night long.
There you go.
So this just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gounder.
Dr. Gounder, always great to have you. Thank you very much.
It is time to look at the stories that caught our eye. And with us now is the one and only Kelly O'Grady. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning to you, Nate. All right, we are going to begin with news that the popular telehealth platform Hims & Hers is being sued by the Federal Trade Commission. So the FTC alleges the company shared users' health data with companies like Meta, Snap, and other advertising platforms without permission. Hims & Hers says it provides what it calls quality confidential care for patients who are seeking medications for everything from hair regrowth to depression. The company denies the allegations and says, quote, information patients share with their healthcare providers is used only in providing care. Next up, President Trump has unveiled plans for a major revamp of Dulles International Airport in Virginia. So speaking from the Oval Office Wednesday, Trump said the project would add or renovate nearly 5 million square feet of space, replace multiple concourses, and remove the unpopular, at least for some, people movers. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says the price tag for all this is around $22.5 billion and would be mostly funded by airlines like United. It's the latest in a string of D.C. area overhauls spearheaded by the president, including a new White House ballroom and the renovations of the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool. And DoorDash is looking to deliver your takeout a little bit quicker by using drones. That's right. Company on Wednesday launched DoorDash Air after securing certification from the FAA. DoorDash says they're developing their own aircraft and building facilities to support the drone-assisted drop-offs. No word yet on when they plan to start using the new tech. And finally, a shocking road rage incident caught on video. Police say they received a call from a driver who said they were being followed after a confrontation. Now, you can see the angry motorist driving recklessly in and out of traffic, cutting off the victim's car. That's when things take a turn, literally.
Don't worry, Sia. Oh, my God. This guy's crazy. And he's driving in reverse right now, trying to follow me in reverse.
That's right. They threw the car in reverse and it went like that for more than a mile, if you can believe. Eventually, the victim pulled into a police station where the backwards driver was arrested and charged with recklessly driving and menacing. That looked like something out of the Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, that was wild.
It's a good thing all these cars have cameras on them now, so they
good
catch
point.
All of that.
Yeah. And if you don't, we sell them on CBS Mornings Deals.
Right. True.
Shameless
True.
Plug.
right, Kelly, thanks so much. Well, turning now to a story that we're following about Academy Award-winning actor Jared Leto. The 30 Seconds to Mars frontman is facing allegations of criminal sexual conduct. In a new BBC documentary, four women accused Leto of targeting them when they were underage. CBS News has not independently verified the claims, which Leto has flatly denied. Our Lilia Luciano reports it's the latest in a string of allegations that have followed Leto for years.
Jared Leto, Oscar-winning actor, rock star, fashion house ambassador. But who is this man really?
A new documentary from the BBC examines new sexual misconduct allegations against Jared Leto, including from a woman identified by the pseudonym Isabel, who said she met Leto when she was 17 and he was in his early 30s.
Alarms started going off in my head, like, what are you doing here? Like, this is not what you came here for.
Isabel claims Leto invited her to a motel room in Las Vegas, then called her into the bathroom.
He grabbed my hand and he, I guess, started, like, touching himself with my hand.
A woman identified as Clara said she too was 17 when she met Leto in California and told him she knew the age of consent was 18. He was 34. She said they had sex at least once when she was underage.
He just kind of shrugged it off like it wasn't a huge concern for him.
And he knew at that point that you were 17?
Oh yes, he did know. Yeah.
Leto has had a decades-long Hollywood career, winning an Oscar in 2014 for his role in Dallas Buyers Club. He's also the lead singer of 30 Seconds to Mars, which is set for a European tour next year.
Hey, Jared, up top for me!
Leto has previously denied accusations of sexual misconduct, including after the digital publication Airmail published allegations of impropriety from nine women last June. And in a statement Wednesday, he said, quote, I have never sexually assaulted anyone in my entire life. These claims are absolutely and categorically false.
Seeing him continue to do whatever he wants to do and get accolades for it is pretty infuriating because he's left a trail of emotional destruction for a lot of young women.
In total, 10 women spoke to the BBC about their alleged encounters with Leto. CBS News has tried to verify the identities of the accusers featured in that documentary and contact them for comment. So far, we have not been successful. Vlad.
All right, Lilia, thank you very much. BTS needs no introduction. Of course, it's one of the hottest and most successful groups on the planet. But now the band says it is boycotting the next Grammy Award, seemingly over the Academy's newly added category for, quote, best Asian pop music performance. Emily Curl with Entertainment Tonight has more on what's behind the move. Emily, good morning.
Hi, good morning. BTS has spent more than a decade breaking through language barriers. Its new album, Arirang, was expected to be a major Grammy contender. Now, BTS's decision not to submit its new music is reigniting debate. Can a new category celebrate the music while dividing the broader community by region and language?
From blockbuster stadium shows to a slew of number one hits, BTS has broken barriers and built a global army of the most dedicated fans. After a years-long hiatus to fulfill their mandatory military duty, their much-anticipated reunion tour will skip music's biggest night. All seven members now posting the same message separately, that they will not submit their music for Grammy consideration, adding, "We hope our music can be heard and loved for what it is, rather than being divided by region or language."
I think BTS is trying to say that we want to see our music considered on a similar playing field as other artists. We don't.
Jeff Benjamin covers K-pop and is a contributor at Billboard, and he says their withdrawal is likely connected to the Grammy's creation of Best Asian Pop Music Performance.
Because on one hand, it would seem to be a message towards inclusion and representation.
Can't call me artist.
But also, when someone has been competing, over competing, to be honest, on that level, and then they still seem like they'll probably get delineated to a separate category, it feels like a bit of a slap in the face.
Grammy CEO Harvey Mason Jr. released a statement Wednesday saying he's saddened BTS has chosen not to participate. Earlier this week, he spoke about the new category on a podcast.
We just introduced the Asian pop performance category. And the reason we put those categories in is so we can honor the music and so we can show respect to that music because it's happening, it's popping, and we want to make sure it's part of what we're doing.
The Grammy CEO also said submitting to a genre category such as Asian pop does not exclude an artist from submitting and being considered for general field categories. We've seen other Grammy boycotts from the likes of Drake, The Weeknd, and Morgan Wallen for the Academy's lack of recognition. But the BTS boycott reminds us that artists don't want to be placed in a box.
Interesting. I understand the desire to try to be inclusive by creating more categories, but in so doing, I feel like it's sort of creating this box of this whole other category.
Because the art should be judged on its merits. And BTS can undoubtedly win and be competitive in a general music category. They don't need to be placed in a category where you're basically signaling to the world, like, this is where their domain lies.
I respect this move by BTS.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, because clearly they would win if this new category is something that they were throwing their music into. They're saying, you know what? No, respect us on a broader level.
That's right.
Because our music appeals to everybody.
To everybody. The artistry is there. So the musicality is there. And we are as competitive as anybody else you'd put in the category.
Right. And they don't even need that validation. They're that big of a group.
That's right.
They're like, we stand on our
Also, yes, you're right. They're probably like, I don't really need a Grammy. We're BTS.
That's a good point. Emily, good stuff.
Always good to
have you. Thank you for having me. I love it. I appreciate more often.
All right, coming up, artificial intelligence is advancing at breakneck speed. Has the world reached a tipping point? That is the question. We will ask one of the leading voices tracking its development. Plus, how looks maxing could actually make men less attractive. Arthur C. Brooks will explain in just a bit. You've probably seen a lot of headlines about AI lately, including the technology going rogue and carrying out an unprecedented hack, and private conversations with Claude showing up on online searches. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman was on Capitol Hill Wednesday previewing his company's newest AI model. He's expected to meet with White House officials today. So, are we at a turning point or tipping point when it comes to AI? To break it all down, we are joined by CBS News contributor Matt Schumer, a venture capitalist and the founder of SomethingBig.AI newsletter. Good morning. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. So it feels like every week we're hearing something about AI, a major breakthrough that either excites us or scares the living daylights out of us. How would you describe the current state of AI right now?
Well, a lot of people are talking about this, and it's a word that you're going to be hearing about a lot very soon. I think we're in what is called the early singularity, the point where AI is improving so quickly that we don't really understand or predict what's coming next accurately. What we've seen in the last few weeks has been nothing short of crazy. We've seen AI disprove math problems that have stumped mathematicians for decades. We've seen it do unprecedented hacks that wouldn't be possible by humans. We've seen it create video games in a matter of hours that look like they came out of a studio working for years. We are truly witnessing something unprecedented.
Are we at that point, though, where machines are starting to outsmart us and where they are starting to go rogue?
It's a bit confusing, right? Because I think overall, as humanity, we are still smarter, but in certain areas with certain topics, AI is getting better than us, right? A human couldn't have created that video game in 24 hours the way an AI did. A human couldn't have carried out that cyber attack. And we know that human mathematicians struggled to solve these problems that AI disproved by literally somebody saying, do a breakthrough. If you look at one of the prompts that somebody used to solve one of these really crazy unsolved math problems that have stumped mathematicians, the prompt was, do a breakthrough. It's crazy.
Unbelievable.
So we know that OpenAI says one of its AI agents recently hacked another company during an internal test. The scientist Carl Sagan often argued that civilizations have to develop wisdom at roughly the same pace or the same rate as technology. So as technology becomes more powerful, the consequences of our decisions, poor decisions, become illuminated. So when it comes to artificial intelligence, do you believe that we have the political institutions, our ethics, the governance to manage this technology safely and for the betterment of humanity?
No.
Okay. So then where do we go from here?
I think we have to try our best. You can see that many of the folks at OpenAI, Anthropic, other institutions have work together to sign a letter advocating for some level of a pause or slowdown in the technology. When I wrote my article 6 months ago, I predicted rapid growth, and it has moved faster than I predicted. The problem is we would have to get China and others to cooperate, and I don't see that happening. I hope it does.
You know, we saw, you know, with Mark Zuckerberg, he's on the other side of this. He's bullish on AI. We talked about this a little bit yesterday, and he doesn't want there to be regulation on Chinese models here in the U.S. And where could that lead us?
Well, I think he has his own reasons for saying that he's trying to compete with the big labs who are quite a bit ahead of him, and that has to do with his strategy. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of players. Everyone has their own opinions. I think that we are not on the right path right now, but we need to get there because this stuff is moving way more quickly than anybody anticipated.
All right, so Matt, let's cut right to it. So most people, they use AI maybe in school or for their jobs, with assistants in their apps. It could be with their medical information or their banking. So they might be listening to this segment on a very surface level. What scares you the most? Just put it out on the table. We're talking 5 years from now, 10 years from now. What is the worst case scenario that you think is actually possible?
I think it's tough to go worst case because this stuff is unprecedented. And when I talk about the singularity, the idea is that we don't really understand what it's going to look like. But there are things people can do today. On the cybersecurity side, you want to make sure you're using secure, strong passwords, two-factor authentication. And some of it is out of your hands. It's in the organizations that are protecting you. Right? Hugging Face, the company that was hacked, had these protections in place, and still they were hacked. The agent found its way inside the system. But also, people need to be using this, adapting to this, learning this. You should be prompting these AIs, learning how to work with them. You can even read my newsletter to understand what is happening each week and stay on top of the news. But you need to be understanding this because this is the way of the future. This is what's happening no matter what.
I have a college graduate, and he is in the job market. Mm-hmm. And this is very much like everybody, the AI is taking our jobs. So if you're going off to college and you're looking at what I should major in, or if you're in the job market right now, what do you say we should be doing?
Well, I think it depends on who you are. None of this is one size fits all. Right. If you're an enterprising young individual and you're thinking about going off to college, maybe it's actually not the best path for you. This is going to be a golden age. This is one of the benefits of this. It's going to be a golden age for creators, for entrepreneurs. People are going to be able to build things with very little capital, with very little time that previously would have took millions of dollars, huge teams of people, and years of their lives. Mm. It's going to be amazing. But if you're somebody who wants to follow the conventional path, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Just make sure if you're going to college, you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a degree, you're not just getting a piece of paper. You're going into a field, and you're aiming to go into a field that has longevity, that's not just going to be typing on a computer, not interfacing with humans.
Mm. All right. We appreciate you giving us the good,
does
the
every
bad,
technological
the ugly.
Civilization eventually encounter something it can't survive?
Yeah.
That's the question.
All right, Matt Schumer, thank you so much.
We're taking a closer look this morning at the viral and controversial trend of looks maxing. It's when young men try to maximize their appearance, often through extreme practices. In his latest column for the Free Press titled Looks Maxing is Repulsive, CBS News contributor Arthur C. Brooks says the trend is not delivering on its promises. Arthur Brooks joins us this morning. Good morning. Good to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
So I've argued, and it was so great to read your piece, that looks maxing has existed for generations, going back to the Beau Brummel Regency era to the 1970s bodybuilding era. But there's something that you say is extremely problematic about the era that we're in now.
Yeah, there's this hard looks maxing idea on the internet where, you know, people realize that they've got 2 seconds to make an impression on other people. Mm-hmm. Swipe, 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 swipe. So the result is you have to make a quick impression, a quick hit. And that means you have to be as beautiful as possible to get somebody's attention. But that's a mistake in thinking that that will actually attract the right people to you, to what you truly want, which is love, and not just that initial attraction. And the truth of the matter is that when men are doing this, they're sending exactly the wrong signal to women that they might want. They're sending the signal that they're vain. They're sending the signal that they're trivial. And the data are clear. I say this as a behavioral scientist. Women actually, when men are doing this, when they're even building their muscles too big, women don't like it. Signals of vanity don't show me a good potential husband at all.
Yeah, but Arthur, would you not also agree that a lot of men are doing this, not necessarily to meet women, but to mog
other men.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's actually, you know, the social comparison aspect of the internet is really everything, to be sure. But underneath it, there's this idea that there's something that we want. We want to be more attractive. We want to have these relationships. We want people to love us is what it comes down to. But it's a complicated thing when you're an adolescent, when you're a young adult and you don't have a lot of experience in life. This is sending all the wrong signals and it's leading to loneliness. It's leading to pathological behavior.
Yeah, I was going to ask you because I have two young men at home, and one of mine follows clavicular and all of these so-called
looks maxers. Does he know that you know that he does?
Oh, yeah, and he knows, and we've talked about that, and he knows it's ridiculous. But at the same time, they're so impressionable. And they're, as you said, it's flooding their social media feeds. You know, how as parents, I mean, what controls do we have when it comes to this?
Yeah, well, to begin with, the most important thing that parents can do, and people talk to me all the time. I have young adult children as well. And people say, what do I do to get my kids off social media? What do I get so that they're not sitting around the table looking at their devices? And the answer is this. Don't look at your devices when you're at the table with your kids. The number one predictor of your kids overusing social media and devices is parents doing that, as a matter of fact. And so the first thing to do is to model the behavior and then put some barriers around it. I mean, we should be sending our kids to schools that prohibit devices in the schools. That's where to send your kids. You should have a rule of no devices at the table, for example. Common sense, no devices absolutely in the bedroom. And start using some common sense.
You say instead of looks maxing, they should focus on character maxing. Explain that.
That's exactly right. Because it turns out that what, you know, the signals that men send to women that women most are attracted to in real life are signals of resource acquisition, of dependability, of commitment. That's what, you know, men want who actually do.
Character traits.
Exactly right.
Who
and that's what your mom taught you and your dad taught you. And that's what we saw from our fathers, which was so critically important. And so what we find in experiments and data and common sense, for Pete's sake, for millions of years probably, is that when men show that they're willing to commit, they're hardworking, they're honest, they're good people, that they actually get the people who will love them till the end of their days.
Always dropping some gems for us. We appreciate you. You know what? They can keep looks maxing. I'm going to focus on Arthur C. Brooks maxing. Because you show up and shout every time you're on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. Hey, stick around. Talk to the Table is coming up next. We'll be right back with more CBS Mornings. Welcome back to CBS Mornings. It is time to bring you the stories that are the talk of the table this morning. And Vlad, it's on you.
Okay, so we've been talking about AI. Let's talk about the very sad reality that I've been thinking about as someone who grew up actually reading physical books. Back in January, the Washington Post reported that artificial intelligence companies like Anthropic are buying and then destroying millions of books to feed chatbots. So they take physical books, they are then stripped, they are scanned, and then the most heartbreaking thing is they are shredded.
What?
The process is happening to both rare and hard to find out of print books. And some booksellers say they went from selling about 20 books per week in April to now selling hundreds to these companies. Anthropic reached a $1.7 billion settlement with authors last year. So I understand the need to put the books into a digital form, but scanning preserves the words.
But why
it actually
shred?
Doesn't preserve the book. Right, exactly.
Right.
Because there is something very special about a first edition that has handwritten notes in that first edition, a unique binding, or even the wear of generations of readers who have held a book in their hands. That's what libraries do. They preserve centuries of our thinking in a physical form. The AI companies are treating books as if they're just data containers.
Right.
I think that that's a problem.
But also just the look and the smell of an
old book,
you open it, it just, there's that richness to it.
100%.
You take that away.
And just think of the world's great libraries that have housed thousands, if not millions, of these books.
And you said that it protects, it preserves the words.
Yes.
But it doesn't protect the integrity.
That's right.
And the authenticity, because it's all digitally downloaded. So who's to say years from now that these words aren't changed or manipulated? You know what I mean?
It's
like the reason we have the physical books
is
to always reference
human civilization, that we have books and we have writings that exist centuries before you and I existed.
I don't like that.
It seems reckless to be doing.
No, I don't like that. I'm going to make it a little more positive.
Okay.
What do you got? What do you
all doom and gloom?
You're going to love this lady. My talk of the table is an 82-year-old grandmother who fought for her right to party. Yeah. Anita LeBron.
I love this.
She asked Minnesota legislators in March to fight an alcohol ban in the state's assisted living facilities. parties. She said residents, they reminisce, they comfort each other over shared drinks. In her words, just because we are older and live in assisted living, it doesn't mean that we should have fewer freedoms than everyone else. You go, Anita.
Right on,
and
Anita.
My friends love happy hour just like many of you do. Well, good news is all the lawmakers agreed. Earlier this month, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz held a ceremonial signing of the new bill dubbed the Grandparents Happy Hour Provision.
That's what I'm talking about.
We all need more Anitas
in our life.
I read
that Anita and her husband, before he passed, that was something that they loved doing. They loved going to Happy Hour, having some drinks. And when she got to this facility, she couldn't do that.
We also talk about, as you get older, the isolation and what that does. So this is a chance for them to be together, to socialize. And we know how good that is. Not only just for the heart, the soul, all of it, the body.
Let them sip on a little something, something.
Yes.
Kudos to Governor Walz for agreeing.
Right.
Yes. No doubt. Cheers to you.
Cheers to you. Well said. All right. So my talk at the table is a sneak peek at my conversation with professional boxer Canelo Alvarez. He is one of the biggest names in boxing with more than 60 wins. But now, at the age of 36, he faces questions about when he will walk away from the sport that he loves.
When I'm there in the gym and I take a lot of punches and then my body doesn't respond in the same way, then I know. Yeah. I'm not going to go and fight with that kind of training.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel you.
Because in the train, you can see everything in the training camp.
Everything. You feel everything.
You feel how your body responds or not, no? But I feel good. But it's not much left for me, too.
Yeah.
For me, I have other things to accomplish outside of boxing.
You know, he comes from very humble beginnings.
Yep.
Boxing was a huge part of, you know, how he grew up and the respect he has for the sport. He also talks about this new generation of young men and women and how they have it a little bit too easy. When he was young, when he wanted something, he went and worked for the money and then spent his own money. And we spent a little bit of time talking about his loss to Terrence Bud Crawford last year because that was one of the biggest events in all of boxing. Yeah. And he says that he wants his rematch.
Oh.
There's a lot going on in this conversation.
We talk a lot about athletes as they mature and what that does to the body. I'm really interested to hear him talk about that.
Yeah, he breaks it down very eloquently. And you'll hear more of our conversation tomorrow on CBS Mornings.
For the first time in more than 70 years, the best female players in the world are taking the field to play pro baseball. And tickets for Saturday's opening day, they are already sold out. The Women's Pro Baseball League launches its inaugural season with four teams. There's the New York Heights, San Francisco Firebells, Los Angeles Queens, and Boston Hunters. Only on CBS Mornings, we're joined by the league's co-founder and first commissioner, Justine Siegel, and the first overall draft pick, Kelsey Whitmore of the San Francisco Firebells. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
So nice
morning.
To have you here.
Great.
And so much excitement about this. I mean, Kelsey, for you, what it is like finally to realize this dream of yours to play. And by the way, you were the first overall draft pick and you're on the Firebells. So what is that energy going to be like taking the field?
Oh, man, it's been a dream of mine since I was a little girl to be able to play professional baseball. And I mean, I have over the years, but with other women, you know, being able to look to my right and to my left and be able to see myself in them is a dream come true, and to be able to be ourselves out there. So there's gonna be so much energy. We're all just really looking forward to it, and it's a blessing.
Yeah. As they say, if you build it, they will come. Justine, you're part of the team that's helped building this. You know, the last Women's Professional Baseball League was, you know, ended back in the 1950s. So what are your goals to create a lasting league for women?
Yeah, I think one that the fans will come out and they'll just see great play, right? These are elite athletes and they're hitting the ball hard and they're throwing fast and just create that kind of energy that we know that our players have a lot of passion and I know our fans are gonna feel it.
So Kelsey, I'm curious about the pressure, and this is probably true of any athlete in any sport, but as Natalie points out, being the number one draft pick.
Yeah.
And then going into this season, you've got the inaugural season on your jersey there. I just wonder what kind of pressure you're feeling, if at all. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're just cool as a cucumber going in.
Yeah, I think at any elite level that you're competing at, there's always going to be a sense of pressure, right? Mm-hmm. You want to win games, you want to do well, and you want to be the best version of yourself out there. But rather than me looking at it as pressure, I try to flip the script and look at it as a privilege just to be out there. And at the end of the day, you know, we're all just taking our experiences and just trying to take the knowledge I can and just be the best me out there I can and enjoy it for the most part. So yeah, of course it's gonna be pressure, but I'm using that as more excitement and just having that privilege to be out there playing with girls.
As a former athlete, let me translate. I don't feel pressure. I apply it.
Oh, that's what she's
saying.
Message received.
Justine, when you were 13 years old, there was a coach that said to you that you shouldn't play baseball because you're a girl, which is absolutely ridiculous. You didn't listen. You became a trailblazer. What does it mean for you that you are creating a pathway for young girls to be themselves and truly lean into their passion of playing the sport?
Yeah, it really means everything to me. Like, I met Kelsey when she was 15, and now to get to sign her for professional baseball, I mean, that's full circle. So it's a real honor, and it really is. It's just a meaningful experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, we saw that moment when they picked you, first overall draft pick there, that little video that you shared. What would you tell that 6-year-old little girl who had this dream?
Oh, that moment when, you know, just hearing your name called and having your family, your best friends, everyone who's important to you all around you, it just hit different. Mm. And I think the first person I thought about was a 6-year-old version of myself and just trying to make her proud. And at the end of the day, being the first overall draft pick, I just looked back at my whole career.
That's so cute.
Yeah, that's her. Looking back at my whole career, and I just kind of tell myself it was all worth it in the end. Yeah. All the trials, all the everything.
Yeah.
Well, Justine, speaking of young women, there was a very special and tender moment when you were announced as the league's first commissioner with your daughter, Jasmine. Can you describe that moment and what she said to you?
Yeah, I had my Jasmine young at 23, so my whole adult life has been with Jasmine. And so she gave me a hug and she whispered in my ear how proud she was of me.
And how did that make you feel?
No words. Mm. My heart was full.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aww.
We mentioned that this weekend's game's already sold out. So looking forward, I mean, and seeing how the growth of this league could just continue, what is the vision moving forward?
You know, to expand into new cities, to continue to build the game, and to get more girls playing baseball.
Yeah, so how do you do that in an era where women's sports are becoming increasingly popular?
Yeah, it's booming right now.
It's booming right now.
And it's great. About time.
But are you worried about the financials? I mean, broadly speaking, how do you sustain it?
Well, we're just starting. So we feel like we're nothing but a rocket ship.
No doubt.
And going to go out and build.
Yeah. The ladies are passionate. They're skilled. They're going to go out there and ball out.
And it's America's pastime.
And the fans are going to support.
That's right. Well, we appreciate y'all joining us. What you're doing is special.
Very cool.
And we're going to go to a game, right?
Yeah. And congratulations, both of you. I mean, it's amazing.
I love these jerseys, too.
Right.
So cool. Congratulations.
Yeah, if you're going to rep anyone, rep the San Francisco Firebirds.
All right. All right. Okay. Oh,
shout out to the
Bay. We got our own New York team here, too, though. So.
Justine, Kelsey, thank you so much. We appreciate you. All right. Starting this Saturday, the entire first season of the Women's Pro Baseball League is played at Robin Roberts Stadium in Springfield, Illinois. You can get tickets and find out how to stream the game live on the league's website. That does it for us. We'll see you tomorrow.
Great day. Bye.